The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do, the podcast where I, your host, Dead Air Dennis Maller, speaks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the Day Job Talking podcast today will be my good friend, comedian Will Abels. Will and I are comedians that met on the road, even though we come from the same state, we lived in the same city. We did not meet until we were both not in our homes. And in fact, we only see each other when we're not in our home cities. Will is a comedian who lived in New York. He now lives in Nashville, Tennessee. He's originally from Maryland, Western Maryland, Westminster area. He lived here in Boston, went to school here in Boston. And now he's a professional road comedian who's doing odd jobs here and there to help keep things rolling, as we all have to do. That is the point of this podcast, is us figuring out how to make a living while doing the art that we do. And by the way, if you're joining us for the first time in the program, thank you so much for being a part of this podcast listening audience. I appreciate it. My guests appreciate it. If I can ask one thing of you, please, if you enjoyed this episode, leave a comment in whatever aggregator, whatever application, whatever which way you're listening to this podcast, leave a review. It helps all of our guests. It helps move it up into the rankings. It helps all those iTunes and Spotify's and Podbeans and Anchors and whatever's. It helps iHeartRadio's. It helps this podcast get put to more people. The more people who listen to podcasts, the more people who discover my guests. That's what we're here to do. Trying to showcase you interesting people that have to do interesting things to continue doing the interesting thing they want to do. So thank you for being here. And if you are a longtime listener and you haven't posted a comment or a review, go for it. Still can use it all the time. Remember, if you came here because you specifically liked one person, one guest, well, review that episode, talk about that guest, because it will help them and it will also help everybody else. So that's the end of my call to action. Thank you so much for being a part of it and doing it. I appreciate it. Also, we are on this podcast is on the Big Comedy Network. Show Big Comedy Network some love too. Follow them on these socials. Anyway, back to Will. This was an interesting because this is a promotional one, right? My buddy Will is putting out a comedy special, which you can find coming out on October 28th. All the information is in the podcast. You can go by 4x3 Productions and view his live self-produced comedy special. We're going to talk about it. You're going to get all that info and you're going to get a lot more because he worked in the production. Basically, he did what I did, but he did in TV. I did it in radio, production support, working behind the scenes. He did it in TV. He was a page for the David Letterman show. He worked in production. He's worked on a lot of different TV shows and sets and live productions. And so he has a good insight to all of that. And I feel like it was a piece of the industry that we have not yet to talk about here on this podcast. So he's providing a very good look into the behind the scenes of the world of television. So please enjoy my conversation with comedian and page Will Abels. All right. Hey buddy, what's going on? How's Nashville right now?
Hot. Very hot.
Yeah. We had a weird, unnaturally humid summer here in Boston early in the year. Usually it's like June's hot a little bit. And then you got halfway through July, you get some humidity. Then August is humid and nice. Like it breaks. And then you get like another week of humidity in September. And then that's it.
Yeah.
We had like all of June was like 90 some percent humidity, which is nothing compared to Nashville. I know. Like we're both from Mid Atlantic. We both grew up with humid summers. We know what it's like. But was it abnormal? Well, this is your first summer in Nashville or your second summer?
My third summer.
Oh my God.
I know.
I was looking at our Facebook stuff, Will, and I was just like, we've been friends on Facebook for almost 8 years.
Oh,
like,
wow. Jeez.
Like that time just flies. Like, I mean, we lost 2 years of it with the pandemic. Sure. But so weather in Nashville, is it abnormally humid or is it normally humid?
Well, so luckily today the humidity broke, so it wasn't too bad.
So wait, you've been in Nashville for 3 years now. How's the Nashville scene compared to, because you've lived in a couple cities, you know, you were part of the Baltimore scene, just like I was living in Maryland and the DC scene. You were here in Boston. Were you doing stand-up when you lived here in Boston yet?
So I started in Boston when I was in college.
Okay.
So I did Boston a little bit right after I graduated. And then Baltimore and DC, I didn't really do too much because when I was living at home, it was during the pandemic, so I only did
Yeah.
stuff from the shows when like we started doing shows. But I mostly did shows in New York. I was mostly like in New York for the majority of it.
Yeah, and you're right, New York.
Yeah.
So how's the Nashville comedy scene compared to all the other comedy scenes you've been a part of? Like what's different about what's going on in Nashville right now compared to New York or Boston or DC?
Yeah. Well, at the moment, I don't know what's going on in Boston. I haven't been back in a couple of years, so I know it's just kind of like it sounds like it's still trying to get its feet back underneath of it. But for Nashville, it's a much smaller scene than I'm used to. So like,
Really?
oh yeah. But it has a lot of headliners that lives here, so it's like this weird balance of like there's not a lot of stage time, but you can run into these people sometimes, and it's a good scene. And it's what's nice about it is that it's easy to go to other scenes for road stuff, because Nashville's very central. So like just this month, I was able to go to Chattanooga and Atlanta, Louisville. You hit pretty easily. Huntsville, you hit pretty easily. I mean, even Chicago is only 8 hours away. So that's the kind of the thing is like we don't have a ton of stage time, but you can go find the stage time if you're willing to do the work. Yeah.
Okay, so it's like a nice centralized location.
Yeah.
So it's basically like we're doing a little bit of work here because we can just travel away from here easier.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why a couple of these guys moved here. Plus, they're from here. So that's sort of like, like right now, our big guys are obviously Nate Bargatze lives here. And
Obviously.
he'll still pop in an open mic, which is just so crazy. And then like Dusty Slay's here. He's been doing great. I think Theo Von still lives here, but he's kind of in his own atmosphere. So like,
Yeah.
it doesn't really matter if he's around or not.
No matter what city he is in, Theo Von is just Theo
Yeah,
Von.
right. And I guess before I moved here, there were a couple guys that came back during the pandemic, and then they've gone back to LA and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always interested in what different scenes like. We all have the same weird, drama. We have the same weird, who sits at what lunch table in the cafeteria, who's the cool kids and but there's still small differences like the Baltimore DC scene, like it's much more working class. They're much more appreciated. But the dirty stuff flies better. Here in Boston, it's the dirty stuff doesn't fly unless you go out of the side of the city to like the sticks, and then it's all fucking middle America stuff like
Right,
that.
because you have the academics in Boston, so they're too smart. They're
Yeah.
too smart for everybody.
They're too sensitive too at times. Sometimes. But all right, so you mentioned that you were at college here in Boston. Let's start with that. No, actually, because you went to Emerson, which was a performing arts school. But before that, where was what did you where what made you start in performing arts? Like I was a kid, little kid, starting community theater, a little high school play, a little elementary school plays and stuff like that. And that was the beginning of my entrance into the world of entertainment. Did you when you went to Emerson, was that the beginning? Was like, oh, this is what show business is like, or were you doing stuff before then?
So I did theater in high school, and I actually did stand up once when I was like in 8th grade.
School talent
School
show.
talent show. I just did like,
Same here. Mine was fourth grade talent show.
I just did jokes from Jerry Seinfeld and Sinbad, actually. I don't know why that combination, but so I did that. Then I was acting regularly in high school. I hosted a couple of shows, if I remember, and then I got into like my sophomore year of college, and then a roommate of mine, we both were like together, and we saw a flyer at Emerson that was like, "Do you want to try stand up?" And we were like, "Sure, I guess so. Yeah, let's try it out."
Well, let's talk about high school real quick, because I went actually to a performing arts high
Oh,
school.
okay.
And the reason I went there is I lived across the street. I did not actually get into the performing arts
That's
program,
funny.
but I did tech theater on the outside. I did improv at high school. A lot of my friends were involved in the theater program. In Hagerstown, was your school big into like there was also schools like in the Baltimore County area that were big into the arts that didn't have the arts program. Like we did a whole festival of Shakespeare plays for all of Baltimore County, where we hosted everybody came and did different Shakespeare's play for an entire day at our school. Was your school in Hagerstown big into the performing arts, or was it just something that was happening there?
I think it was more just something that was happening there. We had like you could take a drama class I think that had like drama one, drama two, drama three, if I remember correctly. But yeah, it was pretty much just like, if I remember, I was one of the only like kids in the theater program, like doing like also playing sports, which was always a problem because I would have to like literally like run from a tennis match, go back to acting, or like run from a soccer match, go back to acting. But yeah, it wasn't huge, but I do remember the guys that did it took it very seriously. So it was always very fun to be around them, and I was kind of the young guy with them because they were like I joined in, and I don't think not a lot of freshmen joined, but I didn't. Oh, actually, I forgot. I did do it. I did two plays in middle school, and then I just naturally joined in high school. But not a lot of people did. So I remember just like being the young guy running around, annoying shit out of everybody, but yeah, but like no, they were good. They were funny. One time, they actually wrote their own spoof of A Christmas Carol, and I played Tiny Tim, but I played conjoined twin Tiny Tim, and it was me.
Conjoined Tiny Twin, Tiny Conjoined Tim.
Yeah, and it was me and this girl, and we were conjoined together, and like the play ends with like Scrooge splitting us in half finally. Like it was such a ridiculous play. Like looking back, I'm like, what did
Like King Solomon, just slice.
Yeah. And I think if I remember right, like that year we did do two Christmas plays back to back, and we had one that was like, thought out and like written by a professional, and then there was like the one we did, and it was just so insane the entire way through. But they were serious. I mean, they're serious about it. So like, but yeah, it wasn't like known for its like theater program or performing arts, but a couple performers have come out. Actually, one of the most popular performers at the moment is from my high school is LA Knight. He's the wrestler LA Knight. He went to North Hagerstown High School.
Oh.
And right now, I think if I've been told correctly by my friends that watch wrestling, he's one of the biggest wrestlers on the planet at the moment. So it's like, oh, okay, cool. Pride of Hagerstown over here might be doing a little better. I might have to challenge him for the title and see who
Ah.
wins.
Well, you have the documentation to prove
Yeah.
that you're the pride of
Yeah, I was
Hagerstown,
first.
i.e. your last
Yeah.
comedy
Yeah.
special.
Financially, he's probably winning, but I was first.
Oh, we're gonna get into the match. LA Knight versus Will Abels for the title of Hagerstown's favorite. All right, brothers, let's get this rocking and
Yeah, I
rolling.
would have to probably like figure out like a stage name and everything too. But maybe I would just go as Will Abels.
So, what made you want to get into Emerson then? Because, like, for me, I always grew up knowing that entertainment was a job, that it was a possibility. A lot of people never knew how to get into it, never knew it was art. Like, a friend of mine has another podcast called TV Guidance Counselor Podcast, my friend Ken Reed. One of the questions he always asks people on his podcast is, when did they know that TV was made by people? And when I hear that question, I think my entire life is like, I think I knew that my entire life. Like, I always knew comedians were a job. I knew that actors were a job. I know that people wrote TV. Like, I feel like I can't remember a time, maybe when I was really, really young, and I was like, oh, Captain Kangaroo's a real person.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a kangaroo. I don't know, whatever. But for most of my, life, I can remember that. So for me, when I left high school, knowing that I could get a job in radio, be a radio DJ, become an actor, be a stand-up, was not far-fetched for me.
Right.
What made you learn that you could go into the performing arts, and why did you choose to go to Emerson for performing arts?
Well, I went to Emerson because first because I got rejected by USC. So that was one reason they accepted me, so I went. I also had offered at UNC Wilmington, but something at that time in my mind connected when I visited Boston versus Wilmington. I was like, UNC Wilmington's a fantastic school, and especially for like production. But I kind of was like, I want to live in a city, like a starter city, and Boston's a great starter city if you want to move to like New York and LA, and that it's a big city, but it's a small city at the same time. Like you can walk end to end in a day if you really want to. I mean, technically you can walk end to end in New York if you want to, but you just might not make it out alive. But that was one reason I kind of ended up at Emerson. And then I got rejected by the film program, which is weird when you really think. I mean, I get it's like you want to be competitive, but it's also like how are you telling an 18-year-old already they can't do something So they put me in the TV production, and that's where. They basically, your first freshman year, they just like, they throw all of it at you. And they're like, here's all the jobs and let us know which one sticks. And then you can kind of specialize as you go through. And then my internship, honestly, is where I really learned how TV production worked. And I interned at Jimmy Kimmel, and they were very much not like, hey, intern, go get coffee. Like, sure, that happened. But they were like, no, no, you're here to learn. So they got us integrated into every single department. I got to know everybody. Even during the show, they would do this really cool thing where, like, I'd sit in, like, we rotate which one of us did it each night. But you would sit next to the producer as she's taking notes during a segment, and then you ran those notes up to the editing room. And because they were editing, Kimmel is, it's, I forget what the terminology is, but like essentially Kimmel airs closest to being live than any other late night, because they're on the West Coast. So they cut it really close every time. So like it's very like high energy during the actual taping. But that's where I kind of learned, like, oh yeah, this is what a PA is. This is what a coordinator is. You know, this is what a segment producer is, and all that kind of stuff. So that was most of my internship. Like, Emerson taught me a lot, but it wasn't really until I got my hands on everything that I could figure it out.
That's one of those weird things about different schools. Like, I always feel like the higher schools are all based on like lecturing and talking and reading books. Meanwhile, I went to a community college for television production and radio production, and we did very little sitting down talking. Everything was so hands on.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I was literally 2 months into my freshman year of college, and we were making a TV show.
Right.
And we were all rotating jobs. And I just felt like we were just, they didn't talk to us. They were just like, all right, just go figure it out. Here you go. We're going to teach you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went back and I became a student teacher, and I would help teach the kids.
Yeah.
And every day before we do our show, we would spend an hour going from position to position, from employee, from job to job, and teaching each kid, all right, this is the camera. Here's your focus. Here's your zoom. Here's the shots that we want for the show. Here's the other shot, and here's your third shot.
Yeah.
You're going to be told between those three shots. And then I move to the next camera person and tell them. Then I go in master and control, teach them how to record to tape, tell them about the spectrogram, make sure that we have a white balance done, and then go to audio and teach that person. And me and the professor are the ones going around teaching all these kids. Every class, this is your position. All right, last week you were doing camera. Now you're in master control. Now you're the TD. Now you're technical director. You're switching between the show. And that's where we spent all our time doing it. And because I learned it the same way. It's like, all right, here's a camera. Get on it. This is follow. This is focus. This is zoom. Get to it.
Yeah.
But schools seem to need so much more lecturing when I talk to people who went to, like, you know, real colleges as opposed to my little junior college in Montgomery County, Maryland.
Yeah. No, Emerson was still very hands-on. Like, we did do the, like, because Emerson has a couple studios built in the school. So you did do the hands-on stuff where, like, you learned how to use a camera. They had a whole camera rental company coming out of like our dorm, you know, like they had all that stuff. And so they also did push you to like go and create your own things all the time. I just think for me, it wasn't until I saw all of it at the internship where it clicked. There was like, you know, a ladder that you had to kind of climb, and then it would branch out and you kind of pick which way you wanted to go. But when we were at Emerson, we did shoot our own pilot once, and that was a class you could take. It was cool. I mean, it was very interactive. It was really cool. I wrote a screenplay. I wrote a pilot myself. Like, yeah, they got you to do the thing, but then you get out. It's sort of like they taught you how to be a producer or a writer, but they didn't teach you how to just get to that once you were out. Like, so when you become a production assistant for the first time, you're kind of like, but I can do all these things. And they're like, yeah, we just want you to get coffee, you know, and it's a little confusing to start. And then eventually you just meet other production assistants. You learn that's just how it is. Yeah.
How competitive is the intern world when it comes to performing arts? Like in that, because like I knew people who would take, like when I worked in radio, we would have people coming in as interns that had no interest in going into entertainment, radio, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, oh, I need an internship for my English program, and this looks like a cool one.
Yeah.
It's like, so why are you here then? You're ruining somebody else's opportunity to get in here and sit with the morning show and actually learn how to do radio and actually make connections. But at a performing arts school like Emerson, that's a well-to-do, big, accredited school. How difficult was it to get into other internships? Were there a small amount of internships at places that were conducive to your major?
Well, a lot of it was There was a lot of opportunity for internships. It was, I think the more stressful part was finding out which one you wanted to do. Because, you know, Emerson has a very good reputation. And like the students are always pretty professional coming out of it. So a lot of it was like, I knew somebody that already did this internship. They're passing the internship on to me. Like I had a buddy that I like, they were looking for interns for the next semester at Kimmel. And I was like, oh, I got this buddy. He's coming out here. You should hire him. He ended up working there for the next like 10 years. Like, so, you know, so a lot of it was just like kind of, as the industry always is, it was who you know. And so you would kind of like reach out to other students and coworkers and or colleagues and be like, okay, who is interning at CAA? Because I want to go do that, you know? And then you would talk to them. And if you guys got along, they would try and pass you along and that kind of stuff. Because it's always weird, like turning in a resume when you don't have one. You know, so you're turning in like all the stuff you're doing in college. And that just seems so ridiculous because it's like, you could just be making it all up, you know, but no, it was a lot of like who you knew and like networking. And that's what Emerson's probably the best at, I think, is just the overall networking is pretty, pretty solid.
Yeah, well, it's not, like a lot of people go back and forth in the film community talking about whether if film school is worth it or not.
Yeah, sure.
And one of the things that always goes back to what makes it worth it is the connections.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can learn everything you'll learn in film school by actually making short films in the making short films in your little home on YouTube and put them out there and watch YouTube videos. But you're not going to make the connections with the people that are going to be in the industry the way that you will if you actually go to film school.
Right.
Is it important to go there? Some say yes, some say no.
Well, I mean, today you can literally just record yourself on your phone, put it on Instagram, and you get 2 million followers. You know, I mean, it's such a different industry from when I was in college. And it was funny.
Same here.
Looking back,
I was still on reel-to-reel tape
when
I was in radio school, and we actually cut film and we did most of our stuff on VHS tapes, but we still learned how to cut film properly.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I started college in 99. Now that we're looking at in 2023, just even from the days of when YouTube started till now, the things that we can do with this phone here, the movies we can make, you know, the it was impossible in 1999 to get a camera.
Yeah.
Oh, it was thousands of dollars. Now you have it in your pocket.
Yeah, you carry it with you every single day. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because looking back, I remember a couple of friends of mine when we first graduated were getting hired as social media coordinators. And we were like, what the fuck is that? Like, that's the stupidest thing. That's the stupidest job I've ever heard of in my life. Like, you're going to manage someone's Twitter. You're going to manage someone's Instagram. Because Instagram was brand new right around the time I was graduating. And now looking back, they're probably all millionaires. I mean, some of them are influencers. Some of them are massive influencers. And it's a $1 billion industry. So you're like, oh.
Yeah. Well.
And now.
And it's just a crazy $1 billion industry that also still makes no sense. Like,
yeah.
In the film world, there's a path, you know?
Sure.
In Instagram, when it comes to the almighty algorithm, it's just a blind crapshoot.
Yeah. So I've been trying to post every single day for a month to see what it does. And it's funny because the algorithm's picked up that I'm trying to do that because I've been posting every day for like 5 or 6 days now. So I'm like, I'm just starting. But now all of the reels that are coming back to me are just like, here's how to manage your Instagram account. Here's how to go viral. Use this sound. And it, like, I didn't used to get that. Like, most of my Instagram is like dogs and like people that like live outside and like build themselves a house and then soccer and like, yeah, of course stand up, but I try and avoid it because it just drives me insane. Because you're just like watching, like, I just don't watch most clips. Like if I watch like if I'm going to watch stand up, I'm watching like Kyle Kinane because I know I'm getting an actual joke, you know, it's not just going to be like, forcing crowd work and being like, so you two a couple? It's like, yeah, of course they're a couple. They're sitting at the same table. Maybe they're brother and sister, but like for the most part, they know each other. Like, give us something, you know? So,
I mean, it's the amount of like terrible content that's rewarded by people. Like, I just, my brain, when it comes to social media, the amount of times like I'm flipping through things and I don't understand just the fact that why somebody wants something. I don't understand most of the time why people like things. Like, I get, like, certain times why people will watch something, But also at the same time, why do you hit that like button? That's the important thing, is why, what's making somebody hit that like button?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like there's plenty of videos on TikTok, Instagrams, all of it, that is like a clip from Family Guy right next to a guy building nailing 2x4s together. So why are you hitting like on that? Or the amount of videos that's like, you know, a repost. It's somebody else's video and it's just somebody there staring at you while that other video is happening. Are you liking the content that that guy's staring at? No, you're liking the content that he's presenting to you,
yeah,
whether that's good content or not. So why are you giving that guy the like for presenting something to you that is not his video? Like, I can go on for hours. The amount of people that just steal TV shows and movies and just put it on the internet, and people are like, yay, you're great because you took a clip of Family Guy. Yeah. Why?
I saw that actually earlier today. It kind of popped up on, I forget if it was on Facebook Reels or what it was on, but someone was just reposting Key and Peele when they're doing the college draft, and they have all the ridiculous names. And I was like watching them, and I was like, wait, this is not their stuff.
Yeah, this is not Key and Peele.
Yeah, like this is not Key and Peele's account, but I'm just watching it, you know? Yeah, so there is something.
And like, maybe we're just sensitive because we are artists and we don't want, you know, like, we know what it's like when somebody takes something from ours and passes it off as their own.
Yeah, well, that was
or even dream about, we know what kind of stuff goes into making a production, and we want the person who's making the thing to get the credit for it. Maybe we're sensitive. Maybe the rest of the world doesn't care. I don't know.
Right, and that was kind of the problem with Fuck Jerry and the Fat Jewish, right? They just were stealing everyone else's content and taking it as their own and reaping the benefits of it, and no one was seeing any money except for them. So so it's not like it's a new thing, because that was Twitter 10 years ago, you know, and we're still talking about this now. It's, you know, and there's a massive writer's strike because we're talking about streaming rights. Like, it's all these things. It's like, the problems have been here and it's just not going to get solved. Like,
and they don't go away. Nobody else cares. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the algorithm. I did my own algorithm test last week to see what was going to happen, because I have that episode that came out with Steve-O from Jackass. So I put up a link to the actual YouTube video of Steve-O and I talking. Nothing. 2 likes. Yeah. The next day, I put up a clip from the episode. Entered it right into Facebook. Right up the Facebook. Right? Not from Instagram. Not from, I put one on Instagram too, but not like, I didn't put a link to an external link.
Mm-hmm.
Got like 5 likes.
Yeah.
And then the next day, I posted a picture of Steve-O, and I never said the word podcast. 92 likes.
Yeah. It just
It's like, if I put the word podcast in my description, Facebook automatically devalues my algorithm and doesn't show it to people.
Yeah, it's like there's keywords that they're looking for, and it's like promotion, like any type of promotion. They're like, no, we're not doing that. Unless you record it on our platform, we're not promoting shit. Yeah.
And here's the worst part. The second one, the clip itself that I uploaded to Facebook, I actually paid to boost it.
Oh, wow.
They did so poorly in the algorithm, they refunded my money for the boosted post.
Hey, look at that. That's a.
They literally came back as like, after the 5 days, they're like, it had zero reach. You're not charging you.
Oh my God, that's a success story. That's insane.
It should be, right?
That's so insane.
Like, Facebook ruined the algorithm for my podcast promotion so badly that they're like, you know what? Here, we owe you money.
Yeah. Let's pay you back. Yeah. And they like added, they added a little incentive on top of it.
So after college, after performing arts school, what was the path? You worked at Jimmy Kimmel. You had an internship. Were you trying to get a job at a production studio, at a network? Were you just blind out in the cold trying to figure it out yourself? What happened after college?
A little combination of all that. I got out. I was freelancing a bit for some Bravo TV shows, just like driving vans mostly. And I was also working in a restaurant.
Doing PA work?
Yeah. Actually, I started at a camera house. Didn't love it. They weren't great. Then, but again, it was an Emerson connection, so that's how I got the job. And then I worked at Letterman for a year as a page, which is kind of like a paid internship. But you're mostly dealing with the audience side of things as opposed to like the TV side of things. And that was very fun.
Let's explain what a page is to people. Yeah. Like, I know what it is, but like, what are the duties of a page at a network like or at a show like Letterman?
So Letterman's different. So CBS has pages and NBC has pages. A Letterman page exclusively worked at Letterman. So we only worked in the audience department, and that is just like booking, ticketing, seating, honestly watching the show and just kind of doing like some crowd control, really. CBS Pages and NBC Pages, as far as I know, they're very involved in the process of what's happening. They do deal with audience stuff, but I think that they actually like are closer to like a paid internship. So that's what, yeah, that's what I did for a year, but also got to watch Letterman on one of his last couple of years before he retired. So that was pretty sick. And it was when he was like sort of getting good again, like getting really good again, and like he was remembering how good he was at interviews. I mean, it was like, God, it was like right before, when was that? So I was there in 2012. So, I guess the world was a little bit of a better place in a way. 2011, 2012. But yeah, so that was very fun. So I did that, came out of that, worked at a restaurant, was doing stand up for the most part, and then ended up working at the Sound of Music for NBC. And then I did live TV for like 2.5 years and then got back into stand up. And I've been doing pretty much just stand up and odds and ends jobs since.
Well, going back to the page thing, you're talking about dealing with the crowd. Like, are you having to shut down hecklers like in the middle of David Letterman's show? Are you dealing with like somebody's like, "Hey, can you guys be quiet? We're recording." Or what are you doing with crowd
It's
control?
mostly as subtle as you can possibly be. I mean, there were bodyguards up there, and security guards, not bodyguards, security guards up there. So like they mostly, like when the show started, they were the ones kind of dealing with it. But you were sort of like we had certain positions where we were sitting there watching and then just keeping note of like that person's getting rowdy. All right, let's go tell the security guard. Or we would just come up and be like, hey, what do we talk about? Because we do all these speeches and stuff beforehand, try and like make sure that everyone's calm and all that kind of stuff.
So you have to go out like pre-crowd work, pre-show, and talk to the crowd and be like, "All right, everybody, here's what's gonna happen."
So funniest, I'll tell you a story because it's pretty funny. So one thing about your boss finding out that you're a comedian working in New York, is that they consistently gave me the drunk people. And so we had to like, because it's a massive theater. So we had to divide the crowds up a bit. And when it rained, we took the crowd to a bar called Three Monkeys. The people we would have some people inside getting speeched, as we call it. And then we had people that were outside and we took them to a bar until the thing happened. This one time I was both teaching a new page and also dealing with like five insanely drunk moms, like smashed, like just hammered. And because I've been going to that bar,
It's Mom's Night
but it's also, no, it's 2 p.m. It's 2 p.m. on a Wednesday. It's insane. It's like in Nashville, you'll see a drunk mom at 2 p.m. on a Wednesday because it's a bachelor party. It's a bachelorette party. Like, so they're not quite a mom yet. They're, whatever. But like in New York, you just don't see that. And so I'm doing my speech, and the bartender was like, hey, well, just a heads up. These ladies have come in here. I just gave them a round. I'm regretting giving them that round. Like, they're very drunk. And I was like, thanks for the heads up. So I'm doing my speech. It goes over a loudspeaker, and there's a two-floor thing. So the people up top can't see me. They can just hear me, right? And so I'm doing my speech. I'm just like, welcome to the Late Show, David Letterman. How you guys doing? And these ladies kept talking over me. And I turned and I was like, hey, ladies, like, I'm happy to hear that you're having a good time. But if you don't hear these rules, then you're not going to be able to go into the show because you're not going to know how to act, And we don't want that, do we? And then they got quiet for a second. I go back to doing my speech, and one of them just goes, will you just shut the fuck up? And I turn and I go, well, I don't have a lot of power here at the Late Show, but I can tell you this much. You're definitely not getting this fucking show. Also, we asked you to dress nice and your hair looks like shit. Or something like that. Like just something like that, or like your clothes look like shit, or I forget what I
Your
said.
hair fell flat, Karen.
And so I go up to the bodyguard or the security guards, and I was like, hey guys, I don't think we should let them into the show. Like they're smashed. And the one guy's kind of a softie, and he's like, I don't know, man. He's like, they're just having a good time. And I go, well, they told me to shut the fuck up. And these guys are all former NYPD officers, right? So they're all retired NYPD officers that are doing security for Letterman. And so I go, I don't know, guys. They told me to shut the fuck up. And the head guy was like, they told you to shut the fuck up? They're done. And he kicked them out. Kicks them out. They come up to me and they're like, how dare you? We're mothers. We're mothers. And I was like, Imagine if I told my mom the way you talked to me just now, and they actually sent me an apology letter like the next day. Because they were
Aww,
like,
when they sobered up.
please don't ban us. We had too much to drink. We are so sorry. It's our favorite thing to do when we come to New York. It's like our one night out, blah, blah. And yeah, so they sent me an apology letter and everything. So yeah. So that's kind of what my day to day was.
To Will, aka shut the fuck up, Abels. We're fucking sorry that you have a sensitivity about being told to shut the fuck
Yeah,
up.
they said something like to the page that like I forget what they actually sent the letter to my boss because they were trying to make sure that I didn't get kicked out. But it was overall it did because then I was getting reviewed to see if I was going to get fired because they were like, "Did you handle the situation correctly?" I was like, "Well, I'm 23 and I'm dealing with a bunch of drunk moms in a bar filled with a bunch of other drunk people." I was like, I thought I handled it pretty fucking well for the best part I could, But yeah, they like reviewed me and then they were like, hey, they sent this letter, so you're off the hook. And I was like, I kind of assumed I was, but all right, thanks for letting me know. Yeah. It's a great time.
So now you're good. Now you've learned how to handle hecklers now in the world of stand-up.
I know, but telling people to shut the fuck up is never great in stand up, but I will say I do it way too often because I don't get a lot of hecklers, to be completely honest. I don't know what it is. I've never had to really become good at crowd work because I just have never had to like consistently deal with hecklers. So my go-to does tend to be, hey, shut the fuck up, which never really sets a great tone, and people get a little bit upset about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about plenty of times on this podcast that I don't get hecklers because A, I'm just loud and boisterous. Two, I talk too fast for anybody to have a chance to get anything is. Three, I will talk over you if you start talking. You will not win a battle with me.
Yeah.
You're not going to talk louder than me when I'm A, talking, two, amplified. You're not going to win. You're just going to get bowled over.
Yeah.
But I do pretty well with talking to people. Now, the big problem I have is with the Boston Duck Tours that I've been doing is I'll be my two lines, which are probably the lines that are going to get me in trouble because the company hates when I do this, is if I notice someone on one of my Duck Tours is talking like right next to me, I'll look, I was like, you guys know this isn't TV and I can hear you, right?
Yeah.
And that'll usually shut them up, which will probably get me in trouble. But the second thing I love to do is if someone's doing their own narration of the tour where they're like, oh, look, that's where your grandfather worked over there. That's the swan boats. Like if they're like pointing out things, I'll just stop and look at them and go, I'll give you the microphone. You could do the tour. I get paid the same either way. And they're like, oh, sorry.
So
which I'm also probably going to get me in trouble, but that's how I handle a heckler. Like I have to be so much more kid gloves on tour
yeah.
With doing tourism around Boston as I am like at a comedy show doing stand-up. If somebody's talking, yeah, we can tell them to shut the fuck up
Right.
and we get away with it most of the time. But half the time I do try to just like, I'm just going to talk louder than you and
Right.
it will work.
Right. Right. If anyone's having like an intimate moment, you're like, nope, not on this duck, not on this duck tour.
Hey, you paid $52.49 to hear me talk, not hear
Yeah,
yourselves.
exactly.
So, what was the working in the TV world? Was that helpful with you when you were doing stand up, or was that just day job? This is my night job. No two should cross over.
No, I mean, truthfully, it got so busy with TV that I stopped doing stand up entirely. I would try and do like a show a month, but I just wasn't really doing it the way I had been doing it, where I was hitting the mics every night and going to shows and, and for me with comedy, I never have really had a mentor, so I never had anyone telling me what I should be doing, when I should be doing it, how I should be doing it. So I had to do a lot of just like figuring it out on my own. So in my mind at the time, I was like, oh, doing one show a month, that's fine, which is just not, that's not how it
No,
works,
not enough.
But I was doing a ton of TV production for those two years or so. And then just one day I was standing in Yonkers for some NBC pilot or whatever it was. It was like 8 degrees outside. I was freezing my ass off and I was like, I don't really want to do this anymore. Like I really enjoyed the experience that I had. Like I worked at the Oscars a couple times, I worked at the Emmys. All the live shows I did for NBC were really fun. Made a lot of good friends, a lot of great connections. But just overall, I was just like, I don't want to do this, Like I don't see myself doing this. And one reason I think I was always good at, because I would always have to deal with the actors a lot, and they would put me around like high-end talent. And I think a lot of that is because as a performer, I could talk to them like a normal person because I was like, I can do what you do. you know, and I'm talking to Chris Evans, you know what I mean? Like I cannot do what you do, but that was always a thing where it's like, I was able to talk to them like on like a very like normal way of not, you know, and being I was always very respectful. I never had a problem with any of the, with any of them. But yeah, no, I just lost interest in it and got back in stand up, and that was going pretty well for a little while. Took a little bit of a fall off again, as we all know. But now I'm, you know, back and doing it again. It's going good.
Was it hard for you being behind the scenes in one aspect of the entertainment life and wanting to be in front of the spotlight in the other aspect? Because as an engineer and a radio person, radio on-air talent and an engineer, somebody who was a Renaissance man doing both behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, I did also have that conflict inside of me where it's like, hey, I'm working behind making talent make sure things go great for them. Also, at the same time, it's like, I can be out there doing what they're doing. Did you ever feel that push and pull of like, I'm doing good stuff behind the scenes, but want to be in front of the scenes?
I'm sure that was going through my brain at some point or another, but because of the shows I was doing, it was a little different. We're like, so like working the live shows was basically working on Broadway, and I've never wanted to go back into like the theater world and that kind of acting. So when I would watch those guys, I never felt jealous of like being behind the scenes, because I knew what I was doing was just as important as what they were doing, right? Financially, they were getting paid more, so their job was a little bit more important because there would be no show without them. But I never really felt that like kind of like, oh, that could be me out there. Like I never felt that because we were basically doing Broadway for TV production. So like, you know, they're dancers. They're so different from what, and they're singers. That, you know, they're these incredible performers, and it was just not something that like I wasn't really watching them as like, oh, I could probably be acting. And then when I would work at the Oscars, the only time I thought I could do what they're doing is I'm not gonna say who the host was, but her writing staff, I remember I was like, oh, I could probably be doing this. But even that, I didn't have like a ton of like, I should be back there. It was just like a kind of a mental note of like, oh, maybe I could like work towards that. And I remember standing on the stage of the Oscars and I was like, I would like to host this someday. But again, it wasn't a like, I deserve this, I'm better than these other people, anything like that. It was just like making mental notes and mental goals to like get there sometime. But no, I never felt like that kind of, because it makes sense. I understand it. But I guess the one time I started working in dramas, and sometimes I'd watch some of those guys and be like, this can't be that hard. But for the most part, like with the live stuff and all that, what they were doing, just because it was so different from what I can do and what I'm capable of doing, I never really felt that jealousy or anything like that.
Yeah, there was one time, I've talked about this before in the podcast, and it's on my wall of backhanded compliments at deadairdennis.com. I had a program director in radio. I gave him an audition tape of me, you know, just talking up songs and whatnot. And he goes, the thing out of the house goes, man, I was really impressed. It shows you know what you're doing. And I went, yeah, of course I know what I'm doing, Rick. Why would I not apply? Why would I apply for a job if I didn't know what I was doing? And he was like, whoa, no, what I meant is you're an engineer.
Yeah.
I only think of you as an engineer. Nobody crosses over from engineer to on-air talent.
Right.
I didn't know that you wanted to be a talent. I didn't know you had a background in talent. It's amazing that you have this brain set to where you can set up you can build a studio and then you can also go in the studio and talk at a break.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's not where two things cross over usually. So I meant it as a compliment because I just thought you were just another engineer like every other engineer.
Right.
And, you know, that was like the duality of like some of my problems with trying to apply for jobs or even just moving from engineering to on-air positions, because they're like, you're an engineer. Why would we give you an on-air job?
Right.
We would give that to an on-air person. I was like, yeah, but I am an on-air person too. Like you kind of get pegged into that production or, you know, the support. You get stuck in that behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I even had jobs that I applied for as a producer in radio and television shows. And they're like, hey, you have a lot of experience in front of the camera, in front of the mic, in front of the spotlight. Are you going to be comfortable working behind the scenes? And I went, yes. Because if you look at my resume, I have a ton of behind the scenes experience
stuff.
Yeah,
too. Yeah.
Like, was that, like, did you ever have a problem with that where you're like, hey, they're seeing you only as one of these things where you're trying to move to in front of camera or as just not even not literally in front of camera, but being more part of the spotlight instead of, you know, focus in the spotlight, being the focus of the spotlight?
Yeah, no, I didn't really have that problem too much. Right now, the only TV I still work in is for Miss Universe. I still like work as a coordinator sometimes for them, and that's once a year. And the reason I only work with them for like once a year is they know that my full time kind of commitment is to stand up, so I feel that need almost every single night. You know,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, when the transition into a full-time comedian. You talked about not having a mentor. So what made you think that what was the impetus for becoming a full-time comedian? Because I know, you know, I could go out on the road and do the stuff, but I don't even have the slightest clue where to start putting out my road work to get enough work. Like, I did the full-time entertainer thing. So I did acting. I did comedy. Like, these gigs came to me, luckily, like trying to find these things on Gig Salad and what, like, I just got an email now about doing a New Year's Eve in Orange, Massachusetts again.
Nice.
And I was like, you know, like, that was a big chunk of money at the beginning of that year for me, was that payment I got to do two 45 minute shows of stand up on New Year's Eve. Where did you find, you know, 'cause you're in New York, you can make money doing spots in New York. But it's really the road where we make the most money, right?
The road is where you make money. In New York, you don't make any money. And that's sort of the problem, is you're living in New York and then you start doing the road. And kind of with some, just like kind of looking back on a lot of it, when I was in New York, I wish I had figured out how to network with other people that were, like, so I had some people that would take me on the road, and that was when I made the most money. So not when I was like, sure, I would headline from time to time, because I put my album out and that's when I started getting headlining spots. But you're getting, you know, $100 a night shows, and it costs you $150 to get there. So First thing is you start racking up a shit ton of credit card debt. That's the first thing you got to do if you want to start doing road comedy. But if I'm looking back, I really wish, like, I only had like one or two guys that would take me on the road. I wish I could have gotten a team of like five or six, so I was working more consistently and working a bit smarter. But I just loved being out there. So in my mind, it was like looking at the calendar. Okay, I'm only booked three times in New York. I'm going to Vermont, and I would go do seven shows in Vermont, you know? So that was the thing, is I just kind of always wanted to be performing. So I just kept going and going and going. And it would lead to better opportunities the next time I came through. Like, it was a lot of paying your dues, coming through, not making money the first time, not making much money the second time, but more than the first time, then hopefully making the most money on the third time. A lot of that kind of stuff. And it was a very fun time when I look back on it, but there's a lot of things of just not having a mentor and not having someone to go, hey, try it this way, try it that way. And I couldn't get a agent for the fucking life of me, which was the funniest thing, because I would have all my, like, I would have friends that had representation be like, oh, like, aren't you working with this guy? Like, don't you work with this guy? Shouldn't you work with this guy? And I was always like, I'm trying, but it just wouldn't happen. And so that's a bit of a goal for mine now, is just to like get someone that can start doing this legwork for me, because I'm just getting older and I'm a little bit tired of it. But I've had all the experiences, and I know what to tell comics now. And I also know what to look for in my own career. Yeah.
Well, what was why move to Nashville? Why not stay in New England? Why not stay in New York? Why not? I mean, you did that. You went back to home thing during the COVID. Maryland's a great place and centralized. What was it about Nashville going there that made you want to go there and continue to doing comedy full time from Nashville?
Well, at that time I was working with a producer who kind of convinced me to move here. She thought it was a good idea. And I don't think it was a bad idea, because I did see a movement happening where a lot of comics were leaving the big cities and going to the South and going to smaller scenes like Raleigh, Nashville. Like, Atlanta didn't open up for a long time. New York obviously didn't open up for a long time. I don't know about LA, and I don't know about Chicago, but like, I wasn't seeing any of my friends moving there. I was seeing them try something else somewhere else. And so the producer kind of convinced me to come to Nashville. I checked it out. The first year was very good to me. The second year was fine. And then this year I've just mostly been booking the road again, which is great. But I also still tape the special here in town. But the way I kind of looked at Nashville is I was looking at like who was moving here, and I don't know. I just wanted to see something different, try a new scene. And I actually do think there's a lot of value in learning how to write for the South, because it's a tougher audience and also an easier audience at the same time. Whereas, like, first and foremost, you have to be funny. And they are okay, like, if you make, they're okay taking the joke as long as they're part of the joke. Whereas when I was performing in New York, very limited things to talk about. You have to stay in a very specific bubble until you get to a certain point that you have your own, you know, brand and genre and that kind of stuff. So for me, it's been good just for joke writing and changing it up. And again, like, as someone who does the road, I was pretty much exclusively the furthest south I'd ever gone was Raleigh. So now this has brought me down to, like, Alabama, all the way down to Florida. Like, so I am learning how to write for kind of everybody. And I enjoy that. I think it's valuable, and I think it's a good thing.
How are you scheduling your days? Like, JP Connolly, my friend of mine, comedian friend of mine in LA, had talked about that he needed to learn to put himself on a schedule, because if he's untethered, he's not going to be able to organize himself. So he has to, like, strict time zone, stuff like that. Are you good at self-scheduling yourself, or have you just figured that out, of that what method works for you?
I can be very good at that, and it just depends on what's kind of going on in my personal life. Like, recently I just got out of a bunch of debt, so now that I have that off my plate, I can go back to focusing on creating the schedule I want to create. Because before, I was just driving through Uber Eats nonstop. I was barely even doing comedy. I was trying to get out of debt. And
what were you doing to make money to get out of debt?
Just Uber Eats. Just a ton of Uber Eats.
Oh, Uber Eats.
Rover. So, I mean, comedy when I could.
There's that part of that gig economy. Like, we did, this is what this podcast is about.
Yeah.
The things that we have to do during the day to support what we want to do at night. And that, I mean, right now is no better time for the gig economy. If you can swallow that pride and go out and do Uber Eats, do DoorDash, do Lyft and ride and that stuff like that. Yeah. Do you have a problem going to those things? Because you know what? Me right now, I have a problem with that. Like, during pre-pandemic, after I lost my job at iHeartRadio in 2018, between then and the pandemic, I did Lyft every once in a while.
Yeah.
Just to, like, make a couple extra bucks when I knew, like, there wasn't an acting gig or there wasn't a comedy gig around. And I needed, like, but I would be so embarrassed to talk about Lyft. I would just say, oh, I'm just lifting just so I can afford new gear for my freelance work.
Sure.
Meanwhile, like, I'm lifting 5-6 days a week because I need to make sure that get that extra little bit of money to pay my bills. So I'm not living, you know,
in the street
off ramen.
Yeah.
Yeah. But some people have that problem. They're like, they don't have that problem. They're like, yeah, whatever. I do it. I don't care.
Well, so for when I started driving for DoorDash, that felt like a lot of wasted energy because I didn't make DoorDash is a fucking scam. If anyone's out there, no, I'm serious. If anyone's thinking about, like, going into Lyft or going into that, do the other things. DoorDash is just a waste of time. They barely pay their employees and they're a billion-dollar company that it's awful. So I switched over to Uber Eats and it actually pays decent. Like, I mean, decent enough that, like, you know, I still got to drive like 5 hours or something like that. But when you think about it, well, it's like 5 hours during the day. You know, I make what I need to make. I do that every day for 7 days, maybe take off 2 days the next week. And I have the money that I need and I can focus on, you know, I also edit videos for comedians. So it's like finding time for that. Unfortunately, I totaled my car a couple weeks ago, but the settlement payment.
Yeah, you were saying that when we were scheduling this and I didn't want to bring it up, you mentioned it.
It's been a rough month.
Like, that's a huge hit. Like, I mean, I live in Boston. It is a metropolitan city. It has a transit system, the oldest transit system in America, and I can get around from city to city, open mics and shows and gigs and work. But if I want to make money, it's out in the sticks, so I got to figure out how to get to the sticks.
Right.
You are in Nashville, which is mostly sticks. No offense to it being a metropolitan city in the South, but I can't imagine getting around Nashville is very easy when you don't have, like, there's not a great transit system down there, is there?
No, there's not a great transit system, but everything in Nashville is only 12 minutes away, and I have a good group of comedy friends I've made in the last couple of years that, like, they've been helping me out and get me around. And another thing is, like, you know, in New York, one thing that was very valuable was having a car, because a headliner found out and they go, hey, I heard you got a car. Can you drive this thing? And you get like 5 minutes, you know, whatever it is. some friends and I have been doing that where it's like, I'm very good at networking and I've gotten a really good network. And so now it's like, I can hit up the producer and go, hey, I don't have a car at the moment, but can so-and-so open for me? And usually that works out, or they figure out a way to make it work out. So that's what I've mostly been doing. But honestly, the settlement I just got for the car covers everything. And I'm like, well, I'm just gonna buy a cheaper car and have a little bit of money in my pocket. And so like it is turning a corner and that kind of stuff. And I probably will go back to driving for Uber Eats. And the sort of funniest thing about all of it is like I lost the car and I was like, I have no fucking idea how I'm gonna make money this month. Ironically, I've been getting all my money from comedy, which as you know, doesn't pay shit, but I've been getting a lot of like really like decent paying gigs this month. So I've been mostly living off of comedy and dog sitting this month, and it's been great. It's been fantastic.
That is one of those weird things, like fortunate, like when I was doing all freelance and all full-time entertainer from 2018 to 2020, I would look at like what things were carrying me through. Like for 2 months straight, I would have nothing but background acting work and I would just be doing all background for 3, 4 days a week. And then that would dry up and then I would get a comedy gig, you know, and I'd have, you know, two private shows, two corporate gigs in a month to carry me through. And then I would have all recording gigs for podcast networks and NPR and stuff. And then it's like goes back to acting. It's like there was this weird cyclical cycle that I kept having every 2 months where one of these arms of jobs is carrying me through that 2 month period to the next period. And then everything changes, those jobs drop. And it's like I can never keep consistent work going. So I was constantly always trying to play catch up. Do you feel that is kind of what's happening now? It's like, look, I lost my Uber Eats jobs, but luckily I got these comedy gigs. And then what happens next?
Well, fortunately, this month my parents were kind enough to help me out a little bit. That money went all went all right back to bills, so it was sort of like starting at zero. You know what I mean? So that was helpful. But yeah, that's sort of how it feels at the moment. We're like I said, I edit videos for comedians, and it's very, very freelance, and it's very sporadic. Where it's like I do 10 videos for them, and then I might not hear from them for a while. The same thing with some comedy clubs that I work with, like, but out of the blue, this comedian I work with just. We're not even finished the contract we started 2 months ago because he just has been he just has doesn't have any footage at the moment, and he just like randomly paid me for the next round, and I was like, "Oh, sweet!" Was not planning on that, you know. And so that's just like money to put in so I can go to a show and whatever it is. So yeah, it's been odd how it's sort of falling into place again, which is great because right now all I want to do is focus on getting the special out, and I need that time to like. Do this podcast, you know, like keep working on my own videos, get work on promotions, like getting notes back to the production company I'm working with, you know. So I'm been pretty fortunate despite how awful the month's been.
Well, the Pride of Hagerstown special was basically a Zoom show
Yeah, it was.
That was recorded and put out. You know, Zoom did all the recording. You just, you know, probably trimmed it here or there a little bit. This is a full production. Where did for this new show? What's the name of the new show?
So the new special, yeah. So I'm considering this my first special because Zoom was more just like a let's try this out and we don't have a choice. But this one's called Will Abel's Alive and Well. I recorded it independently through our DP's name was Cooper Smith. He does music videos all around Nashville. He's fantastic, and I am releasing it through 4x3 Productions, who's a really they're a newer but they're very ambitious comedy production company. They also do their own films, they do all that kind of stuff. But like they kind of fell on my radar a while ago. I believe it was Harrison Tweed was releasing a special, and so he was the one who got me in touch with them. And they've been like no complaints working with them. They've been so like just transparent. And they're on top of it. Like I don't have to follow up with them on anything. Like they've been great to work with. And I'm really excited to release it.
How did you get hooked up with this production company?
So I was kind of paying attention to them because a couple of comics that I've met on the road, I just saw they were releasing through this company called 4x3, and they were guys kind of like me, where a special is definitely something we need to be doing, but no one's asking for it. You know what I mean? And so I reached out to I reached out to Harrison Tweed in North Carolina, and I was just kind of like, hey, I saw you that you might be working with these guys, and then he got me in touch with them, and so that's how it kind of came together.
Well, talk about what, you worked in production. I've worked in production. We both know what cameras are good, what people are legit. Like we've both met, the guy who's like, oh, I started a production company, i.e., he has a wealthy set of parents that bought him a camera, and now he has a gimbal, and now he's a production company.
Yeah.
While at the same time, we know the people that have been working in the industry and what they're doing. Like, here's a great example. I'm not going to say who, but here in one of the, not here, but in one of the, my friendly comedy scenes, a couple of guys got approached by a production company to do a recording, a multi-camera recording of a theater show that they were putting on in a city. And, you know, afterwards I got back to my friend and we were talking. He's like, yeah, that was a waste of money. I'm like, why? What happened? It's like, well, this, that, whatever. Like, they, you know, said that they wanted to do the special, this and that. And then we got the footage and none of the footage matches up. And I was like, wait, you mean to tell me that you're having trouble color correcting? You all didn't shoot in the raw? And they're like, yeah, I don't know what that means, but apparently nobody did that because they all have like their own like color grading built in on it. And so it's like camera to camera doesn't match up. You know, the audio is fucked. We've lost one of the camera footage for like 10 minutes. And it's like,
oh my God,
what production was this? You're like, yeah, like, oh, it's just this guy. And it's like, yeah, here's the, you know, you knew what to look for in a production company. What bad things have you seen out there from other people were like, oh, here's a red flag for me to stay away from somebody like that?
Well, I mean, again, like I said, like a lot of my career has been trial and error, right? So my first album that I did was in 2017 and we lost all the audio. So we ended up releasing it from the audio on my phone, which, yeah, sure, it doesn't sound good, but it was an experiment that ended up becoming the number one album on iTunes. Fucking whatever. You know. But I learned from that, okay, because I had one friend doing all the work. He was filming, he was doing everything, and it was just too much work for him to do. So it wasn't his fault. It was just like he had too much on his plate. So there, first time I learned, right? So then when we did Zoom, I learned all these different backup things for audio. So the audio, it ironically sounds pretty good, even though it's a Zoom album. You know, you can tell it's on Zoom, but it's like the audio is very clear. And I met some new guys to work with as like an audio engineer. Like I learned about that, right? And then this time around, it kind of became a budget thing where I was like, I had two guys that could have edited the audio for me, but distribution wise, where was it going to go? And so I kind of thought I could release independently. I'll own the rights. I don't have a big following on YouTube. I don't have a big following on Instagram either. I mean, I have a decent following, but not like enough that it's going to really like do the numbers I want to do. So I'm looking at some of the stuff on their page. And I was like, let me talk to these guys and see what they're thinking, you know? And just based on our conversation, I was like, oh, these guys aren't going to fuck me. They give you, like, they give you a good deal. And they also, they don't just fight to get you on YouTube. They're going to fight to try and get you on a couple other platforms, which is like more exposure, the better, you know? So like just, I have a pretty good bullshit radar after doing comedy for 15 years. And so just based on just one conversation, we talked for like a half hour and I was like, okay, I think these guys are going to be the ones I want to give this thing to. And so far it's been right. Yeah. But I haven't really, see, the thing is I haven't really come across anyone that's approached me to do some of that stuff. Like, I'm sure if I look back at my career, there's been moments like that. Like I've definitely worked with CD producers and like, you know, and all of that. And you find certain things out later on.
Well, me as a radio guy, as a comedian, a radio guy, and a guy that works professionally in podcasts, the amount of comedians, like big name comedians that hired shitty open micers to produce their podcast and they don't do any work on it. They just stand in the background and laugh and then upload it to fucking Podbean drives me up the fucking wall. Yeah. Like so many high profile, like I have great sounding audio on my podcast and people ask me, how do you get great audio? It's like, because I'm a fucking professional.
I know what I'm doing.
Not just some kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is a trend in comedy that I've noticed in the last couple years is a lot of people are making their way in because they own a nice camera and they own a nice microphone and, you know, they'll work for cheap enough and they'll work for stage time. And, you know, look, everyone's got their own hustle, so I'm not knocking it. But sometimes I watch the material and I'm like, imagine if you were like just going to the open mics and working, you know, but at the same time, I do watch some people that I'm like, oh no, you've really created a pretty good fan base for yourself by doing this. So, you know, it does work and it's frustrating, but comics are all broke, so they're going to try and find ways to cut corners. So why not like take advantage of an open mic comic who's just trying to get in, you know?
Yeah, I just like so many of it. Like, there's so many podcasts I listen to where it's like, somebody edit this, please.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Oh, but c'est la vie,
sure,
as the old folks say.
Yeah.
So, what is the what's the plan for after this special? Well, first off, when's the special being released?
So we release it on September 28th. The link should be live sometime in the next week or so. But yeah, so it comes out September 28th. It'll be on 4x3's YouTube page. Unless something's happened that they haven't told me. But that's the last I checked, that's what we're doing. And then the plan afterwards, there's not much of a plan. I mean, I'm putting together some shows in October. But like, you know, it's kind of just like, I guess, just start thinking about what the next project is, you know, start writing new material and keep plugging it as much as I can and getting on podcasts and just doing that whole thing, you know, just doing the circuit and making sure people know that it exists.
All right. One road tip. Like, I love that the secret little, like, when you're living on the road, doing shows, traveling, there's one tip that everyone has, like Brad Sherwood Sherwood, guy from Whose Line Is It Anyway, his tip was to take the hangers out of your hotel room and use it to close the blinds of the curtain so you can get total darkness. For you, you're on a much lower budget.
Yeah, a little bit.
Hotels aren't even in the conversation half the time.
They've been in the conversation once or twice.
What's your road trip tip? What's your road trip tip?
Oh boy. My road trip tip. Honestly, travel with somebody. You know, I mean, just cut down on costs as much as you can. Split gas, split an apartment, or split out Airbnb, whatever it is. And also just like pay attention to each other's sets and give each other notes just so you can keep working. So you can just keep working, you know, making the set as good as you can possibly make it.
I think that's a great tip, especially for anyone doing comedy, is that you and a buddy.
Yeah.
You got to be responsible for each other. Right.
Yeah.
Because too many of us have that. Like, oh, it's my friend, whatever, I don't care, whatever he's doing, it's fine, you know, and
yeah,
we're not
yeah,
keeping
yeah.
each other honest.
Right. Like, I travel with a guy named Brandon Jarrell, and he's a couple years in, but he's very good, and it's sort of fun to watch him, because he's still got the, like, light in his eyes, where it's like me, I'm just like, let's just get this over with. But that's one thing we do in the car now, is, like, we try and tag each other's stuff up, and, like, if we're working on new bits, we run by each other, and we try and take advantage of the time that we have to think about what's the next project, what can we do, you know, and we try and keep each other motivated. And that's half the battle, is just trying to keep each other motivated.
Yeah, I feel like I was, when I lived with another comedian friend of mine, you know, I live with two comedians now, but I mean, it's completely different. But when I lived with another comedian, when we were doing things regularly before I moved into this apartment, when we were just keeping each other motivated. And even though I was still going to more open mics and booking more shows than he was, I think it was just that friendly air of competition of like, oh, if Jesse gets a show, then I need to go out and find me a show.
Sure.
But also keeping each other honest where it's like, hey, you need to go message bookers right now.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course, you know, working on each other's materials, like, hey, you did good tonight with this. How about this? Or, hey, you know what? That didn't work. What about thinking about this? You know, and just sitting around and just pitching. You know, we lived with each other, so we had to always constantly pitch at each other. Because we're just sitting here going, all right, what about this? What about that? What do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And just forcing each other to go to open mic. So you're right. That is a great tip in general, is just having another comedian with you that you can lean on each other and keep each other both honest.
Yeah.
Well, Will, this was great having you. It's one of the things, like, we are like comedy friends that only get to cross paths every once in a while.
Yeah, sure.
So it's like we're both from like Maryland. We're both, you know, residents of Boston. We're both comedians. We already, like, when we met at the Baltimore Comedy Festival a bunch of years back, like, we just had an instant connection. Like, we both know who each other is.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that we never talk about the beginnings of where we came from, because we don't have that, like, origin story conversation.
Yeah, we met right in the middle. Yeah, sure.
We met, and also, I don't think we've ever met each other in the towns that we live in at the time.
Oh, yeah, I know. I always see you on the road. Yeah, it's always when I see you.
We're just, yeah, like, always just time, hanging out on the road at different
I think last
venues.
Time I saw you was in Worcester. I think you were in Worcester last time I saw you.
Yes, right? It was.
Yeah.
Well, it was good catching up. I can't wait to see the special on YouTube, and I'm wishing the best for you. Where can everyone find your links?
So you can follow me on Instagram at Will Abels Comedy. And then YouTube's also at Will Ables.
A-B-E-L-E-S.
Yep. And then
it's a very weird spelling of Able.
Yeah. And then go to 4x3 Productions YouTube page, 4x3 Comedy, and follow them. Links should be coming up soon. And then you just start, you know, you click on it. And then they notify you on the 28th, and you either watch or you don't watch. That's how it goes.
And if you need video editing, also reach out to Will, because he also needs to pay those bills.
If you need clips, I'm a clip guy.
Awesome. All right. It was great catching up, Will.
Yeah. Great seeing you, man.
Time.